Accession number 10165, reel number 45.
Mr. Martin McLean, reel 45. What happened as the division concentrated? What happened next?
Well, once you're in a defensive position such as we were, on top of the hill, you're out of touch with everything. You don't know what's happening around you. You don't know how the troops are dispersed, other than you are in a position, you're in control. The command officer's got you on the net, the wireless net, so that if anything happens, you get informed. But we didn't know what was happening behind us, other than the DIV commander refused to budge the DIV until he had all his equipment with him. Now, it appears that I've mentioned that we're travelling 1,700 miles by road to get to us, and they were racing them. And they travelled, the drivers were working 20 hours a day to get the transport and everything up to us. And speaking highly for British type of transport, I read in reports there's only about two lorries broke down in that whole journey. But they did have the Remy along with them who repaired it all, put them off the road or got the stores back. So the whole DIV received its stores. The whole convoy arrived on the 14th of April. So we had been there 10 days, which is a long time, because where from our position was, you could look across on the beautiful green valleys and beautiful hills, which looked really picturesque, you know, like a holiday sort of thing, something they'd like to go and visit on a holiday. And away in the distance you could see Kohima, a high hill, always surrounded by smoke and cloud, where the battle and the fight was going on. In there had been the Royal West Kents and the garrison made up of Indian troops and Gurkha troops and some Burmese soldiers as well. They had been cut off entirely from Dimapur by road from the 1st of April. So they had been battling out for 14 days, surrounded by the Japanese, and taking a severe piercing from all the stories that were coming in.
Did you do any more patrols or see any signs of the Japanese?
We were just getting ready to move on. We were making strong defensive positions, as a matter of fact. We weren't sitting around. We were then making revetments in our trenches and putting splinter proofs on the top. In other words, making real defensive positions that somebody else could take over, and if we went forward and field, someone else could take over some of the infantry crew.
How did you go about those two things in those conditions?
Well, I told you before that everybody had matchets. Well, it so happened I had a circular saw. The carriers, which is the track vehicles, they carry in them a little saw, expandable saw. It folds up, and there's two handles to it, and you can cut with it, and it's a little sharp saw. It's about 2 foot long, and it's capable of sawing through trees. Well, I'd obtained one of them. No need to go through all the detail of where I got it from, but I was always on the lookout for that type of stores that would be of assistance to us in our active role. This was borrowed by 9 platoon, who were the 4 platoon on this thing, and they were cutting down trees with these and making revetments. And the saw went right round until somebody really fixed it up and broke it, and that was it. But we're using the saw and our matchets to get the revetments for. Revetments is the wood that you put in your trench to support, to make it strong. To revet proper, you should have wire to bind it to little stakes in the front, but you don't. In other words, we're just knocking posts and putting shelters on the best we could without the necessary proper equipment for to make a defence position.
You put wood above the trenches, you splinter proof.
Yes. We learned that from the Arakan. That was most important. When you're in the jungle, it's not like fighting in the desert, where the percussion of the shell or the 3-inch mortar bomb or the mortar bomb hits the ground and explodes up and out. These things were hitting trees and they'd send all the shrapnel and things down on top of you. So it was important that you had revetment above your head. A revetment or a shelter with earth on top. In other words, you're looking like you see them on the coast where the coast guards are looking out to sea, a little bit stuff over the top of the head. That was my principle right after Dunkirk, always to have shelter across the top. I told you about the positions that we took in in Hamilton Hill, where I had all the positions made with splinter proofs on, we'd done the same. The men thought I was a bit of a driver, but it was with intent to save lives. So we spent 10 days on this.
Did you put wire out? Was wire? You haven't mentioned wire. Did
we
you
had no wire. Part? We had no wire. But there was wire there. There was a string of strand of wire running down the lower parts of the hill. These were most likely put out by the people who were in Dimmapur, you know, when the scare first started. And hanging from there was these anti-personnel grenades. They're a big grenade that the engineers used to have, Royal Engineers used to have, and disturb the wire, and the thing would fall off and explode, and it was so segmented, something like a 36 mils grenade, so it was split up into many, many pieces of metal to catch however was in the area about knee high or body high. They were hung suspended in the air, and just a tremor of the wire and away they'd go. These things were festooned around the hill, but not our responsibility. That's the only wire we had. No, there's no wire. I never saw any wire in Burma at all. Defences was just your weapons and whatever you had. On the 14th of the month, I told you, all the transport arrived and orders came flashing over the wireless sets. Moving out tomorrow. Moving out first light tomorrow. So my company led off the road down onto the... led off the hill down onto the road, and we followed B Company, who was our point battalion. Three battalions had gone in front of us, and we were moving off in brigade groups. There was the Worcesters, the Camerons, and I forget the other red battalion, I think it was the Dorsets. They moved off, and then we followed on with our company, B Company, leading our brigade group, our three battalions of the brigade. We were second company after behind B Company, and we're set off on the road in our staggered formation on each side of the road in section strength, always alert, always ready. Some had their rifles down to on guard position just in case of ambush, because you're in a jungle area and they could come out the trees and start fighting.
Had they made you use the Sten yet? Because you mentioned
no,
earlier.
We hadn't used it. They were loaded. We hadn't used them yet.
No, but were you carrying one yourself?
Yes, I carried a Sten. Right, I had the Sten before. You've got if you cast back a bit, you'll find that I had the Sten gun when we went into Belgaum, and we had to load the magazines in case of being attacked by not enemy but by the animals, and then we took them out again, and on our way up to Dimmapur for where the Japs had got across the lines, we loaded all our magazines and all our equipment. You've got to look at it this way. We had two pouches, infantrymen, and you had a lot of magazines for the Sten magazines. I think they held about 20 rounds or 22 rounds. And you didn't have room for your ammunition in the pouch as well as the magazines. So the only answer was to fill your magazines and put the magazines into your pouches, which completely filled the two pouches. You might have room, you might have grenades or something in one, and you might have the magazines and the other, but you had no room to carry spare ammunition. We took the road to Kohima, and this is where once again we're wearing our steel helmets. It was a fiercely hot day, and the person I said once before who thought of the idea of putting large leaves under the helmets to protect our insulators against the sun, I think that man should have got a medal. It was definitely a winner idea, that. And but these steel helmets that just make the heat hot on our heads, which they did do. But they were insulated quite a bit with these leaves. And we marched along this road with our battle-type order, already ready, anxious for a fight. I say anxious. Everybody was moving quickly in order to get into relieve Kohima. Now, I'm not saying... trying to say that we're brave men, but we realised what them infantrymen up the front were suffering, being surrounded for all that length of time, with lack of water, lack of getting out their wounded, lack of ammunition, lack of everything in the way of, that the troops should have. And we were very anxious to get forward and relieve Kohima. And you could see the urgency in the movement of the troops forward. There's no dilly-dallying, there's no slouching around, they were moving with intent to get forward and relieve Kahima. At 32 milestone, the Worcesters ran into a Japanese block across the road. I'd like to describe the road for a moment from here. Let's go back to Dimapur. Dimapur was a huge base. It was surprisingly large for what we had anticipated. I didn't have a look around it, but having heard reports about it, it was a huge base where they had the Royal Engineers, they had hospitals, they had the ordnance depots, they had vehicle parks and all this sort of thing in Dimapur, because they had Indian troops in the area. But more so, which made the place much larger altogether, and the reason for the Yankees' presence was this. Further up the road, 200 miles into Burma, was Vinegar Joe Stilwell. He was one of the army commanders who commanded an American army and also a Chinese army, who, through the leased land business, had undertaken to supply warlike stores to China. They used to supply this by sending lorry loads of stuff from Dimapur through the Burma Road into India. Quite a long journey. Used to wear the lorries out in one journey, but they carried their loads through.
Into China.
Into China. And the Japs had cut this Burma Road. So the whole base was really a supply base by the Americans for this war they were fighting, which was only incidental to their main aim. Their main aim was to supply China with goods. So they were involved in a war to open a new road into China. They were making the Lido Road. The Lido Road was a road that the Medals Marauders were a type of commando unit which consisted of engineers and infantrymen, and who had volunteered for this hard type of work, or dangerous type of work, like our commandos. And they were pushing forward this road to join up with the part of the Burma Road that wasn't cut to get these supplies through. Now, for this, they had two Chinese armies, I think, and they also had a lot of Americans. I don't know the consistency, but they were commanded by this miserable old general who hated the British, always called us Limeys. I never met the man, but I've read a lot about him. He always called them the Limeys, and he was called Vinegar Joe Stilwell. Vinegar because of his sourness, not only to us, but his own men. Well, they were supplying China. Therefore, Dimapur was really a huge base for stores, for stock. The Burma Road had been closed, and further up somewhere near where the American army is fighting, they'd made some big aerodromes, and had lots of aircraft up there, and they were flying the stuff over the hump. Over the hump meant the very high hills, the high mountains, and were conveying them into China. And Dimapur consisted of a huge base, bristling with stores and vehicles and transport and people. As we left Dimapur behind us...
You were describing the road.
As we left Dimapur, we were walking along a roadway that was built apparently by the army. It was a sandy road, and it was made around the top of hills. In other words, it cut a site, slunks out of the hills, and we were walking along hills and winding twists and turns. Instead of, well, let's put it this way, we're walking on this road, and on our left was a very deep valley. Deep, I mean, really, we talk about deepness in England, but nowhere comparison to the depth of this place. The hills slid away gradually down to the bottom of this valley. And right along this valley, at the end of the valley, you could see Kohima. Kohima was a very high hill. It was all surrounded by hills. But let's describe the place. Down this valley, beautiful green-looking, lush jungle area. Lovely coloured trees and all that sort of thing. And all in the background, mountains and hills and hills and hills, and they all seemed interwoven with one another, making a beautiful panorama, a beautiful background of sights worth seeing. A person would pay to go and see it. We walked along this road, and we could see the battle going on around Kohima. We could see the shells landing. We could see the smoke in the area. And we could hear the guns firing. We could hear the racket of the machine guns. I don't know exactly how far we were away from Kiama, but sound travels, as you know, across these open places. But we had bumped this Jap position at 32 milestone, and that was when we had time to look around us while we were waiting until a further order to move on or to do something. The bus that I said had hit a roadblock across the road. Now, this just shows you how cute the Japanese were. A lot of these are unwritten reports, not report any books. These are actual happenings that we know about that maybe reporters don't know about. They had the independent Japanese army work, the independent Indian army working for them then. People who are against the British being in England, in India, and they want us out, and they joined joined up with the Japs. Now, they'd used some of these men in their Indian uniform, soldiers, in their Indian uniforms to dig defensive positions in this hill. Now, they must have Jap people with them because they didn't just dig, as we do, on top of the hill. They tunnelled the whole of this hill area underneath. And they had pillboxes that dig under like a mine, and then they'd put saps off and they'd make gun positions pointing out like a huge fortress.
And they'd done all that in 14 days.
They'd done that. Goodness knows how long they'd been doing it, but there they were doing it. And the Japs took it over, and the Indians withdrew, or whatever it was. Maybe the independent army stopped with them to help. Well, our division hit this thing, and the div commander stopped all movement forward, and he brought all division guns, everything that we had, and also all the other guns that was assisting in the area, to pound this area with weaponry. With artillery. It was such a terrific barrage going on. We heard it and saw it. We weren't far from it, really. And then we heard the shrieks as the Camerons went in and the Worcesters with the bayonet afterwards. Well, it would appear that all the artillery that was hitting this hill, the howitzers, everything that we had really shaken up the Japs inside. And a lot of them were stunned, but the Camerons apparently got into this bunker and killed everyone that was in it. They had done a good job. They didn't take too long with it either. The whole plan was conceived and completed, I'd say, within about 6 hours. Now, these three battalions were apparently licking their wounds, you know, sorting out their wounded and refilled charging with ammunition. And it came over the wireless set. You've got to get this idea of a company on the move, the three platoons that we have, three sections in each platoon, walking staggered, one section leading, another section on the left of the road behind the first one, and then the third section behind. And there'd be three platoons walking along in that place, but somewhere in the middle of there would be company headquarters, which was the sergeant major, the company commander, the runners, the signallers, and the stretcher bearers. Always travelling with me was the signal set. It was the walkie-talkies, we used to call them then, dears. A huge cumbersome thing the man carried on his back, which wasn't very efficient. India couldn't supply the batteries for them, but somehow or other our technical people got round and they fit batteries in that didn't last too long. And so sometimes they get good reception, other times weak. But whenever there was messages from the command officer, he'd use the wirelesses to control his companies. Order came through, move, B company lead, C company, an order of march. Move now. And that's all we got. Now, as soon as we halted, we took all round defensive positions. Each company takes its own round defensive positions, as we'd been trained for Burma. In other words, if a surprise attack came in from any flank or the rear, we were ready for them. We sought back on the road again. Now, everybody alert, everybody's weapons down, ready for instant use. Moving along the road. And there was another halt a short while afterwards. B Company had run into a part of 161 Indian Infantry Brigade, and they had been surrounded also. This brigade had been withdrawn hurriedly from the Arakan to go to the assistance of Kohima, but they couldn't get there. They were cut off and surrounded. And they were, I think they called the place Lancaster Gates. It was just a technical name given to that place where they were. And they were obviously delighted to see British troops, and there was Indians there and British troops and British officers. delighted to be relieved and all this sort of thing, but they didn't move out. And all around them you could see the actual where ambushes had occurred, where fighting had occurred. Down the hill were some carriers. Two carriers had gone down a steep slope and had jammed against the trees. And I went down to have a look at them. I was always curious in these things. I was standing around doing nothing, waiting to move on. And in there I found, just round there I found a kukri, an Indian, a Gurkha's kukri. Beautiful thing. I brought it to him and it's now at the DLI Museum. Went back on the road and we got the order to move on. And these people were now going to, the 161 in Brigade were told to stay fast. That for the time being, and we got more established. I don't know the orders, but we assumed that. They didn't move out quickly. You know, glad to get away from the place. Big company moved further on, and they come under fire from a hill. And so everybody into their all-round positions, waiting of orders, explaining to the command officer what happens. Command officer and all group comes up. They plan a fire plan. Fire plan involves the use of Royal Artillery, the use of all weaponry to knock the Japs off the hill. B Company was ordered to go and attack this hill and take it off the Japs. The hill itself was called Terraced Hill. It had been used for tea planters. We assume that because the whole hillside was built in terraces. There'd be a wall of stone and then 15 to 20 yards of green where the crops had grown, and then another stone wall, and then another flat, and so on, like that up the hill. The whole of the hill was like that. In other words, it was a very hard hill to attack and take. But Major Allen, who was the company commander, deployed his company into a pincer-like movement using a battle plan, which he spoke about before. In other words, he had his Bren groups occupying the Japs in their position that they'd located by Bren gun fire, whilst the others enfiladed around the sides, and they cleared the hills of Japs. They'd done a good job. They killed over 50 Japs. That was the official report. Without those that were wounded, but they cleared the Japs off that hill. And right towards the last, and of course, we're in contact with a set, because the same set that Major Allen's reporting on is coming to our company headquarters, and we are getting the full details of what is happening on top of the hill. They cleared the hill, and Major Allen's just given a report about they've cleared the hill when some Japanese who was supposedly dead or wounded shot him, killed him. We were very sad about that because we liked this officer. We liked all our officers. Let's have no flam about that. We were, by the way, commanded by a new command officer, Lieutenant Colonel Brown.
You seem to have liked this batch of officers more than you liked the batch you took to France in 1939.
I liked these officers very much. Maybe we worked more with them. And the officers were more condescending. They wouldn't give you a direct order. They'd explain what they wanted. They'd tell you what to do. And they'd listen to your reasoning. Whereas before, they were dogmatic in the previous instance. You will. No question, no argument. You will. But we used to discuss things as officers and men.
They also seem to have been present in action a little more than... There was a slight tinge of officers disappearing during I'm thinking, yes, of the Dunkirk retreat. They seem to have been more present.
There was no disappearing. They were all there on the job with us all of the time. We had great respect for them. Now, that coming from me, because I built up a defence of not liking officers, but that coming from me is a credit to the officers themselves. Sadly, a lot of them died in this battle. The major had been killed, and they took the hill, and the next order that we got, C Company, move on. That means just we come in from all... We saw this battle going on. You got to get the picture of the men. We were all keen to get Fort Relief Kahima. We knew one of our companies was involved in a battle. They were having a bit of a stiff time at once. It didn't stop. It wouldn't have taken two flashes for somebody to say, "Hoy, lads, help them." Then the whole company would have been up to help them. That was a sort of keenness that was in the battalion at the time. We're own mates were being killed. We're friends. They're having a bit of a struggle. If somebody just said, "Hoy, lads, go," we'll get them. But by the sort of control the company commander had over his men, he retained them in the area. If we'd been ordered to go, they'd been away like a shot up the hill. And in other words, the men were keen to get the battle to relieve Kohima. We got the order to move on, and we moved on. And lo and behold, this was something remarkable. We couldn't get over the shock of this lot. All of the war, we'd only seen enemy tanks. We'd never seen a British tank and with us in action. And I'm talking about an infantryman. We'd only heard them, read of them, seen about them in the Middle East and all the tanks there. We never saw a tank. And many a time we could have done with them. Two grand tanks came along, practically brand new tanks, driven by the Carabiniers. I remember them, the funny name that they had. And they were stationed with my company for a forward advance. And they were rolling along with us. And away on the left of this valley and at the bottom of this valley, I saw some people digging in. And to me, they looked like Japanese. I didn't have binoculars. And I drew the attention of the company commander. And he swung his binoculars on and looked at them. And I couldn't decide whether they were Indians or Japs. But I said they were Japs because they're making their defense positions looking down the valley. And I wanted the artillery, the tanks to shoot them up. But discretion won, and maybe he consulted the command officer of the set, moved on. We move further on, we get the order, halt, stand fast. Straight away, we make all round defense positions. Now, we are close to Kohima now, and champing at the bits to get there. I've expressed this time and time again, we wanted to help these lads, desperately. They were in a desperate state. There'd been a big battle the night before at Kohima, and we knew that in a bad state. The Japs were trying to take this hill before we got there, and they also wanted to take it for their own personal reasons. If they got a hold there, we would have taken some, you know, moving them. We got this order to halt. And then it came over the set. It's been decided to give the Indian regiments the honour of relieving Kohima. After the British had done the fighting, it was all diplomatic, this, you know. And then the brigade that we'd relieved in the first instance, one of their battalions, went forward. And they went forward in an extended order. They were very good. They seemed very well trained. Some were down in this valley, some on the roads, some up the hills, but they were going along in line. We watched them, and they got into Kohima and relieved it. And we were delighted, but they went in and they had this honour. Of course, it was emblazoned on all the papers, all the wirelesses, on everything that was news media. Indians relieve Kohima, badly besieged Kohima. Well, we eventually got orders to move on, and this Indian battalion had cut across country to Kohima. They didn't keep on the roads. We come across roadblocks of damaged vehicles that had been, you know, causes roadblocks, all sorts of shot up vehicles. And then we come across another group of 161 Infantry Brigade, Indian Infantry Brigade, who'd been, went forward to help in Kohima, had got cut off and were surrounded. They were delighted to see us. They'd been well involved with the battles. And they were dirty, disheveled, stinking. You could see, no fault of theirs, there's no water to even drink with. There's water supplies, but they couldn't get out for the snipers and things like that. They were dirty and disheveled and delighted to see us. And their wounded lying waiting pathetically for help. Well, we were told to let them out straight away. And these lads couldn't get away from there quick enough. They're walking. And they brought armoured ambulances in, because the Japs were sniping all over the shop to get the wounded out. They had to take the time to get the wounded out because there was only one ambulance, I think, armoured ambulance, shuttling back and forward to Lancaster Gate and then back again, picking them all up.
Where were the Japanese sniping from?
From the hill of Kohima and all around us, you could see. Because we were now looking from our low position on the road. We took over this area from this brigade. I didn't like the area at all. I didn't like the defensive positions in it. I'll tell you the reason why. I was now well experienced with war. And the whole brigade, the whole crowd of us, seemed to be on one big flat plateau on top of a hill. They'd never dug in. They just depend on the ridges of their land in front of them for cover. Now, our contender, one good shell or mortars dropped in that area, it would knock the company out, never mind two or three. So I got the men in my platoon scraping